Record temperatures are already scorching parts of Europe this summer. Cities around the globe have run out of water. And some of the Democratic presidential candidates say it is the top issue, but some continue to doubt that climate change is happening. Welcome to The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. Climate change is our topic today. And later on, we're going to take a look at how climate change will change our region's shorelines and the effect rising waters will have on homes and businesses and power plants and ports and so on. And is there anything we can realistically do about it, or should we be thinking about moving to higher ground? With that in mind, we'd like to get your thoughts. How do we save ourselves, our kids, our grandchildren? What should be done? Email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org. We have two places to find us on Twitter. First is at FullStoryWSHU, or you can find me at RonRopiakWSHU. And finally, we're also on Facebook at The Full Story. But before we get going, to give us some background as to how we got to this spot and where possibly we're going, let's welcome to the program the author of the best-selling book, The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming, David Wallace Wells. David, welcome. We appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
David, you have one of the best opening lines in a book I have read in a while. You write, "It's worse, much worse than you think." Now, look, it's the line that almost every story or interview with you begins with. It's kind of the modern version of, "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times." Now, look, I'm sure you watched the Democratic presidential debates or you saw some of the coverage. Do you think the political establishment has finally gotten it that it's much worse than we think and that maybe Al Gore wasn't Chicken Little after all?
Well, I think many of the candidates, maybe even most of the candidates on the Democratic side, are aware of the scale of the threat and the sort of urgent need for action. Unfortunately, I don't think that the debate moderators were so focused on that issue. And when they did talk about climate change, it was, I think, in a kind of an unsatisfying way. But I think that illustrates a broader point, which is that, it's not this whole crisis that we're in now, the climate crisis. It's not something that can be solved with a single silver bullet innovation. It won't be solved through a single political breakthrough. It won't be solved if a particular leader takes it on as a particular cause. You know, if we don't just need Jay Inslee talking about climate change, we also need Chuck Todd to be focused on it. We also need the audience to be aware of it and pressing those candidates out on the campaign trail about it. We also need all of the other politicians who are not on that stage, who are not running for president this year, to be engaged in similar ways and to be pressured by their constituents. And we need all of them to understand that the sort of economic business opportunities represented by fast action on climate are just as appealing and just as exciting as those that may be there if we don't take action. It's such a complicated, large challenge that I think we often look to single moments or single breakthroughs as though they're going to either make or break the problem. But I think it's a much more overwhelming, all-encompassing challenge, which we all find ourselves engaged in too, not just the people on the debate stage. But on the on that question, I'm quite excited about what those candidates have been saying. If you had told me a year ago that they'd be having this kind of arms race of seriousness about climate, which every week a new candidate has a new plan with a different dollar commitment, all of them measuring in the trillions to how to outlining exactly how they might answer this challenge, I would have told you that was impossible to believe. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we're here now is in part due to a lot of the activism we've seen. It's in part due to the extreme weather we've seen, which has really woken up a lot of people. And I think it's in part due to the UN, who put out a report last October that really opened a lot of people's eyes about just what was possible and just what we had to do to avoid what are truly terrifying scenarios.
Sure. I want to clarify, you're not a scientist, just in case there are those who really don't know you and you've been all over the news. You're not a scientist. You're a writer. You've even said at one point, I believe, that you're not an environmentalist, or you weren't an environmentalist at one point. Your articles and your writings are based on your interviews and your research. So with that in mind, do those whom you're interviewing believe that there is a way out of this? I mean, can we make changes to save ourselves, or Is it too late to avoid catastrophic change?
Well, it sort of depends on what you mean by it's too late and what you mean by catastrophic change. I think that, you know, the sort of lay public tends to think of this issue in binary terms. You know, can we avoid catastrophe? Will we be okay? The truth is, warming is a spectrum, like any other kind of complex phenomena, and we can make the planet relatively warmer by producing relatively more carbon emissions, which happens when we burn more fossil fuels primarily, or we can choose to burn less of those, produce less emissions, ideally in short order zero emissions, and sort of stabilize the planet's climate. I think if we had a sort of global dictator who could command and control the entire planet's economy, its research and development budget, its social and economic priorities, that we would be able to take action today, given the technology we have, to keep the planet below 2 degrees of warming, which is a level that the scientists of the world often talk about as catastrophic, and the island nations of the world describe as genocide. But even at that level, we'd be dealing with, a recent study showed, 153 million deaths from air pollution. We'd be dealing with dying at the scale of 25 Holocausts. We'd be dealing, a report just out today, but from the UN, said we'd be dealing with 80 million fewer jobs globally. There are impacts that are already here today at 1.1 degrees of warming. We're already seeing dramatically more wildfires in the California West. We're seeing unprecedented hurricanes. We're seeing impacts on drought and famine, public health impacts. These are so to the extent that you want to preserve a world that is untouched by climate change, that's impossible. We're already in a world that is being shaped, in some cases, somewhat dramatically by climate change. And I think that it would be quite difficult, given the political institutions that we have and the cultural institutions, economic institutions that we have, to avoid 2 or 2.5 degrees of warming this century, which would bring about some truly scary scenarios. Say, you know, many of the biggest cities in South Asia and the Middle East becoming unlivably hot in summer, which would mean cities that have 10 or 12 or 15 million people in them, you wouldn't be able to go outside without risking heat stroke and death. You certainly wouldn't be able to walk outside.
Sure.
And
and then you point to India. But in the meantime, France, just the other day on Friday, South France, 113 degrees?
Yeah, I think it was even a little higher than that. You know, these are impacts that they're distributed unequally, and it's the people in the sort of equatorial band of the world in the global south who are going to be hit most intensely. But you're absolutely right. The changes are afoot everywhere. And they're going to get, I would say, quite dramatically worse. But the question is, ultimately, how dramatically worse? And we're on track now for about 4.3 degrees of warming this century. That would mean a global GDP maybe 30% smaller than it would be without climate change, which is an impact that's twice as deep as the Great Depression. It would be permanent. It would mean parts of the planet could be hit by 6 climate-driven natural disasters at once. It could mean twice as much war. It would mean our agricultural yields would be only half as bountiful as they are today, and we'd be trying to use those yields to feed 50% more people. And where on the spectrum we fall between where we are now, 1.1 degrees of warming, and where we're headed, 4.3 degrees of warming, is really ultimately up to us, because the main driver of this story is how much carbon we put into the atmosphere. It's on us. Nothing is set in stone. We're determining that climate future ourselves every day. And on some level, even the scariest end of the spectrum, the really scary outcomes that I talk about, are a reflection, in the end, of our power over the climate. So whether, you know, it may sound terrifying to have twice as much war as we have today, but another way of looking at it is that we are so in command of this system that, based on what we could do through emitting additional carbon, would so transform the landscape of the world that we would have all of these dramatic changes. And what that suggests is that if we choose to take a different course, we could be living in a world that would be dramatically transformed in other, much happier, prosperous, fulfilling, and green ways. And how quickly we're able to do that, or how dramatically, how significantly we're able to move down that path as opposed to the path we're on, it's ultimately a question of human will, our politics, our culture, and what kinds of changes they will accommodate. I think, you know, it's sort of hard to make predictions because so much of it is about human uncertainty. But I would say I think it's unlikely that we stay below 2 degrees of warming. And I think it's unlikely that we get all the way to 4 degrees of warming. So where we end up on the spectrum
Yeah, I was going to say, it's because you wrote that science, all science is provisional. It could be better. It could be worse.
Right. And it's probably the case that there will be revisions made to existing science over the next decade or 2 decades or 10 decades that show some of the things that we now think are inevitable because of climate change turned out to be bad predictions. I think that's how science works. But when you take in the full volume of research, all of the thousands of scientists in all of these different nations working at all these different universities all around the world, every day publishing new research, the overwhelming majority of which is pointing us in a bleaker and bleaker direction, I think it's hard to take too much comfort in that scientific uncertainty. And also important to keep in mind that it could work in the other direction, where in the next decade or 2 decades, we actually get a much darker understanding of where we're headed than we have today, which is frankly the direction that all that research is heading in already. So many more papers are published showing that our earlier estimates were out of date and too slow, and that the better modeling is, you know, suggests a much faster warming picture, which is terrifying.
David, I only have 20 seconds before I have to take a break. But with those 20 seconds, there are those who continue to not believe in climate change. What do you think about them?
I don't think there are that many of them. The Yale polling, which is the gold standard, says 73% of Americans believe in climate change. That means 27% don't. But 26% of Americans believe that aliens live among us, and we don't give a veto power to those people over our NASA policy. We shouldn't give veto power to climate deniers over our climate policy. 73% is a lot of Americans who are concerned about climate change, and it's certainly sufficient to take dramatic action.
David Wallace Wells is our guest. He's with us for the next segment. David, hold on 1 second. He's the author of The Uninhabitable Earth. We'll take a short break. It's The Full Story on WSHU. It's The Full Story on WSHU. We continue our conversation with David Wallace Wells. His book, The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming, topped the bestseller lists around our warming globe. If you want to comment on today's show, you can email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org. Two places to find us on Twitter. First is at FullStoryWSHU, or find me at Ron Ropiak, WSHU. And finally, we're also on Facebook at The Full Story. David, over the weekend, I read your latest article in New York Magazine entitled Disaster Upon Disaster. You had two words in your article which really jumped out at me. Sequential catastrophe, which basically describes what we're going through now. And again, how many seem to think that what we're experiencing now is now normal. It's normal news.
Yeah, I think that's worrying in part because things are going to get considerably worse. So it may, on a certain perverse level, be comforting to think, okay, we're now in a new situation where, for instance, over 1 million acres are expected to burn in California every year, or we're expected to see, you know, this many hurricanes in the Caribbean every year, or the Midwest is going to be dealing with this amount of flooding every year, or in India, heat wave, water shortage, typhoon, all in 1 week. And those are scary scenarios, which a generation ago we would have been horrified to know that we were normalizing. But I think it's also problematic in the sense that it gives you a misleading picture of what's coming down the line, which is that each of those impacts is going to intensify and probably be joined by additional ones happening at the same time. You know, I used to be asked all the time, I still am asked all the time, is there one kind of one kind of dramatic impact that will shake us all out of complacency? And I used to answer, well, I don't think it'll be one thing. I think it'll be a string of things, because if we have one, say, hurricane or one terrible wildfire or one drought, and then we revert to an experience like we had before that event, I think it's pretty easier for humans to just sort of move on and normalize and forget just how bad it was, and that really we'd only start to wake up when we were unable to normalize, when weather didn't allow us to normalize because it came one disaster after another after another. But we're starting to see that pattern already, and unfortunately I don't see, you know, a dramatic uptick in public concern on that metric either, or by that prompt either. I did a story a few months ago, a long feature on the California wildfires, and spent a bunch of time in LA and in Sacramento with Cal Fire. And I had to keep saying to people in California, you know, I'm a New Yorker, and I literally don't understand how you could continue to live here given what's happening to the landscape, how much worse fire is getting than it used to be. And they would all respond and say, well, you know, last year was a bad year, but we've always had fire.
Mm.
And I would have to say, well, no, it's, you know, last year was like the Woolsey fire in Malibu last year was twice as big a fire as ever had burned through L.A. County before, ever. It wasn't just a little bit worse. It was twice as bad as the worst previous fire in L.A. history. And, you know, I talked to the mayor of L.A., Eric Garcetti, who said a couple of remarkable things. But, you know, his personal story also illustrates the trajectory here quite dramatically. He's 48 years old. The year he was born, 60,000 acres burned in California. The year he was elected mayor in 2013, it was 600,000, so a tenfold increase. The year he was reelected mayor, 2017, just 4 years later, it was 1.2 million, so a doubling in just 4 years. And last year, 2018, it was 1.9 million. And he said to me, there's nothing we can do. There's no amount of firefighters that we can hire, no amount of fire engines that we can buy, no amount of brush that we can clear that will help us stop this. The only thing that will stop this is when the Earth's weather system, probably long after we're gone, relaxes into a more normal climate state. But I think his constituents are already normalizing some of these intense impacts, and I think we're seeing that all around the world. You know, this heat wave in France that was just hit last week, they hit a high temperature of 45 degrees Celsius. The 2003 heat wave in Europe, which killed 70,000 people, was considered completely unprecedented and historic at the time. It barely crossed the 40-degree threshold.
Mm.
So in just 15 years, we've raised the ceiling on what is possible for a heat wave by almost 5 degrees. And yet, it's not like people are responding to this heat wave in Europe as though it's a totally normal summer. But I think they're not yet recognizing just how totally beyond the benchmarks of normal we are, and how much further we can still go if we continue to warm the planet.
David, I have to tell you, I spent over the last 10, 15 years or so a lot of time in California, and I agree with all the comments that you heard, because I heard those exact same comments. Well, it'll get back to normal sometime in the future. Now, look, I only have you for 5 more minutes, so I just want to get in 1 or 2 quick other questions. Over mm-hmm. the weekend, I read an article in The Guardian about what climate change scientists and others are advocating for us to do right now. And here's a partial short list that some of them are doing. They're saying, stop flying. Or if you have to go on a flight, you get to go on a short flight every 2 to 3 years. That's it. You need to go vegetarian. And this one, I mean, these all jumped out at me. And they said, stop buying stuff. You just stop buying stuff. You don't need to buy anything else. Use what you have, and that's it. Don't forget about those new clothes. And here's something that everyone on a Monday will be happy to hear. They say you need to only work 4 days a week, a 4-day work week around the globe. So what I'm reading about is, and these are coming from the climate change researchers and scientists, they're talking about changing everything that we're doing right now.
Well, we do need to zero out on absolutely everything that produces carbon in our economy, which is almost everything. We need to not just reduce our emissions, we need to completely eliminate them in order to stabilize the planet's climate at any temperature. We need to do that even if we got to 5 or 6 degrees and it was really hellish, the environment that we found ourselves in order to even stabilize the planet at that level, we would need to totally zero out on our carbon emissions. But exactly how we do that is a much more open question. So we need to, we need to make sure that in place of all the carbon that we're producing by flying around the world now, we produce none of that carbon. But from my perspective, it's much more realistic to imagine the rapid development of carbon neutral planes, electric planes, or planes that fly on zero carbon jet fuel than it is to imagine the entire planet giving up on air travel entirely. Same with diet. It's much easier for me to imagine the world's governments legislating new agricultural practices, which we understand them today, would say produce the raising of cattle, turn it from what's called a carbon source, that is something that produces carbon, to a carbon sink, that is something that absorbs carbon, or that we require them to feed those cattle seaweed, which could reduce their methane emissions by as much as 95 or 99%. There are solutions like that all across the spectrum, and we need to make many, many changes like that. In fact, we need a quite thorough reimagining of everything that we think of as modern life. But from my perspective, it is much easier to achieve that through government action, through policy action, than it is through individual action. Because if you and I and everyone we know, everyone that ever gave a single passing thought to climate change, if we persuaded each of those people to entirely give up flying forever, that still wouldn't solve the problem, because there would be other people in the world who aren't so concerned about climate change, who are not going to be voluntarily giving up that service. And if we really take seriously the idea, which is not just an idea, it's a fact, that in order to really take control of this, we need to eliminate carbon emissions entirely, we simply can't rely on the voluntary behavior of well-meaning people on the environmental left, because there aren't enough of them and their actions don't add up to enough. Mm. What does add up is politics, which can allow us to channel that activist energy into a total transformation of what behavioral economists call the choice architecture of our lives, such that we're not choosing between a vacation that's going to impose a terrible carbon burden on the future or one that imposes no carbon burden on the future, but choosing between a variety of transportation options, each of which are responsible when it comes to climate change. And that is possible if we redirect our politics in that direction. It just hasn't yet happened.
David, I have you for another 45 seconds. And with that in mind, do some of us owe Al Gore an apology?
Well, I think of him as a great hero. So to the extent that he has been beaten up over the years, I think that is unfair. I think that in general, we focus on hypocrisy to distract ourselves from the job at hand. And ultimately, you know, sometimes what is called hypocrisy is the desire that we live better together and more responsibly together than we can manage as individuals. That's not a disgusting impulse. That is an empowering, noble impulse, and it's really what politics is for. We don't ask the world to build a social safety net out of donations to philanthropic charities. We build a tax system to ensure that everyone is contributing their fair share, and to then organize those dollars in a way that we find will be effective. That's how we run public schools. That's how we run the army. There's no reason why action on climate should be different or be required to, you know, so that everyone is required to do their part entirely through their individual lives. We need political structures that can channel those commitments into actually meaningful action, rather than demand that anyone who is concerned about climate gives up meat or gives up flying before they start to get counted as a good actor on climate. We can all be good actors by making a good politics come into being.
David Wallace Wells, The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. David, thank you. We appreciate your time. Come back on the air with us at some point.
Thanks so much. I'd love to.
Thank you, David. Be well. Bye-bye. Now, we're going to continue our conversation about climate change and global warming with one particular area of emphasis, what rising waters are going to do to our region's coastlines. We have two guests for you now from the First Street Foundation. Professor Jeremy Porter is academic research partner at First Street Foundation, and he's also a professor at Columbia. And Matthew Eby is the executive director of the First Street Foundation. Welcome both. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having us.
You're a nonprofit. You're based out of Brooklyn. Appropriately, you're on Water Street there. Matthew, what do you do?
Yeah, thanks so much for having us. We really lay out the quantification and communication around flood risk. And what that means is we look at the risk of flooding to an individual property, and we calculate what that risk is today and how that'll change in the near-term future based on changing environmental factors like sea level rise. So it's one thing to understand what your flood risk is when you look at something like a FEMA flood map and you see you're in a flood zone, and it's a completely other thing to understand what your flood risk is when you look at it over the duration of a mortgage, or you're looking at a bunch of multiple factors around what the flood risk is for your house versus just a zone overall. So that's what we try and make simple for people to be able to understand and make the right decisions over a longer period of time.
All right. So, Professor Porter, with that in mind and with that wonderful explanation, our listening area basically is Long Island, Connecticut. Tell us about the rising waters in our region and what that means to us.
Yeah, so the rising waters in Long Island and Connecticut can't really be separated from the topography of the area. The topography of the area has really been defined by sort of glacial forces and things that have occurred over time. But what that's resulted in are a couple different distinct areas. So on the north shore of Long Island, for instance, you have a really rocky, higher elevation of coast. On the south shore of Long Island, you have more of what you would think of as a sort of gradual sloping coast that goes into the beaches, and then in Connecticut along the Long Island Sound, you end up having the topography that, again, is very low and sloping and ends up lots of times creating what we would think of as sort of estuaries and swampy areas where water, because of the topography of the land, can easily climb above the elevation of land. So what it ends up doing is we have a lot of places along Connecticut and along the south shore of Long Island. If you think about Long Island, all the way from Jamaica Bay, the Great South Bay into Shinnecock Bay, Napique Harbor, we have all of these areas where if you get on the bay side of the waters, then you end up having a lot of inundation and sea level rises affecting that, where we're seeing more and more tidal flooding that's occurring in these areas. And then in Connecticut around Milford and Bramford and those types of places, even Norwalk and Stamford, we're seeing more and more tidal flooding, again, because of the topography of the land and that sort of low-sloping land into the sounds.
Matthew, I understand that. And, Professor, thank you for that explanation. Matthew, I understand that it's going to go up. Is there any way to quantify it? How much will it go up? And is there a timeline?
Yeah, absolutely. So when you look at a bunch of different projections into the 2100 timeframe, that's when you really see disparity around sea level rise projections. But if you look into the near term, into the 15-year, the 30-year timeline, that's when you can actually get more concerted and agreed upon shift of what sea level rise should look like for the area. And within that, you can actually, each location is different. So depending on what the land area is made up on, it may be sinking or it may be rising. So within that, that actually adjusts the sea level rise because the water could be going up, but if the land's going up, then it won't be going up as quickly. Or if the land's going down and the sea level rise is going up, you actually see an exacerbated amount of sea level rise. So each location is actually quite different across the country. And Dr. Porter can probably explain kind of the actual projections in the Long Island area in Connecticut better than I.
Okay, Professor Porter, go ahead. Professor, are you there?
Yes, we were listening to your previous guest, and some of the projections that go out to 2100 are starting to talk about feet of sea level rise. For instance, if you look out on at Montauk, the expected sea level rise within the next 15 years is somewhere between 6 and 7 inches. So it's not, we're not talking about feet of sea level rise. We're talking about a half a foot at that point. But that is significant when you start to think about the lower elevation and the topography of those areas. We've done a lot of ground truthing in these areas, and we've really found that in around the Jamaica Bay area, if you get over into South Queens and then on even into South Nassau County around Freeport, Massapequa, and then I actually live in Babylon Town and in Lindenhurst and Babylon there, where there's a lot of areas that are experiencing tidal flooding from the increasing sea level rise. But what we see is the projections in those local tide gauges are that the sea level rise is more about a half a foot over the next 15 years, as opposed to trying to project out to 2100.
And I'm assuming everyone can see these projections if they go onto your website?
Yes, we have all of the projections. We actually have integrated it into our Flood IQ tool, but we also have sealevelrise.org, which gives you regional projections. The Flood IQ tool is nice because it only projects out 15 years. It shows you sea level rise and also shows you different scenarios of flooding. So frequent flooding, flooding that occurs 10 times a year or more versus the once-a-year annual highest tide versus some of the NOAA tools that we use, the SLOSH models. There's a little bit of hurricane inundation that's also built into the model.
Matthew, we're going to get both of you back in the future for a longer discussion. I'm sorry I only have a minute left. With that minute left, I just have to ask you, I've seen all the plans to build seawalls, breakers, huge projects to keep Mother Nature out and the waters down. With the numbers that you have, are such projects going to work? Should they be pursued?
Yeah, absolutely. The idea that we can find adaptation that allows us to live with water is one of the main things that we're going to have to deal with, because as your previous guest pointed out, the actual changes in the environment are baked in to some certain extent right now. So we are going to see these rising waters continue, and if we don't figure out ways with adaptation to actually deal with it, then we're going to be in a much worse situation. So that money being funneled into these adaptation solutions are absolutely critical at this time, because we are not seeing the worst impacts quite yet. As time goes on and sea level rise continues, if we waited until the actual impacts were there, it would be much more severe and a lot more difficult to actually deal with. So it's critical that we're talking about these things now, and knowing the actual impacts of the future and what that'll be.
Matthew Eby, Executive Director at the First Street Foundation, and Professor Jeremy Porter, Academic Research Partner at First Street Foundation and a Professor at Columbia University. Thank you both, and I promise we'll get you both back in the near future for a much longer conversation.
We appreciate it. Thank you
so much.
Thank you. It's The Full Story on WSHU. A short break. We'll be right back. It's The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. We're talking about rising waters in our region because of global warming. And we have two more guests for you. Allison Branco is Director of Coastal Programs for the Nature Conservancy in New York. And Molly Babin is going to be joining us in a few moments. Molly is a college student volunteer with the New Haven Climate Movement. Allison, I'd like to start with you. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? Thanks for having me today.
I'm fine. Thank you. It's our pleasure. Thank you. You know, we're talking about our possible future because of climate change. Yet I see it was just the other month that you gave a speech. Let me see if I can get the title right. Coastal Adaptation, Harnessing the Power of Nature to Protect People. Give us an example, please.
Well, so when we say that, what we really mean is that nature is all on its own quite resilient to rising sea level, and as long as we give it the space that it needs, it can adapt to this rising sea level. For example, beaches and dunes and salt marshes will migrate inland as sea level rises, but the problem is that we've built right up to the edge of them, so they don't have any space to do that migration. So if we can just back up a little bit and give them space, then they can stay along our coastline. And what happens then is that they act as sort of a buffer, protecting us from storm energy and wave energy. All of the erosion that you see and all of the grasses in the salt marsh, they absorb a lot of storm energy. So when we have nature between the people and the water, then we're protected.
Now, when you say back up, you mean you take all those homes that are there, the businesses, the condos, the hotels, the motels, and pull them back?
In the places where we've built all the way to the edge, in some cases that may be necessary, especially on those very shallow sloping coasts where just a small rise in sea level will translate to water coming quite far inland. And so there are some places, especially on the south shore of Long Island and in Connecticut as well, where that's the case. The slope of the land is very shallow, so even a little bit of sea level rise is going to have dramatic impacts.
You know that there is some business owners and people who are listening to this program right now saying, I'm not going to move. I mean, that's expensive. I don't have the money to do this.
Of course they're saying that. And change is very scary. It's human nature to resist change. But the fact is, change is coming. The water is coming, whether we like it or not. So, you know, what we really need to do is sort of come to terms with that and recognize that, rather than just waiting for it to happen, and being sort of caught off guard and having a lot of problems because of it, we need to be proactive. You know, we have a lot of good science, as you just heard from your last guests, that tells us what kind of impacts and changes we're predicting in the future. And so what we need to do is sort of plan for those changes now, before it gets too bad. We need to start making plans to figure out where we need, if people need to move, where they're going to go, which places people can stay, which solutions are appropriate and which locations, and then begin the difficult conversations to figure out how to implement them, who pays, where are we going to find all this money, all of that.
Well, you're talking about the future, but you are seeing changes now, aren't you?
We sure are, absolutely. On the south shore of Long Island especially, we're seeing not just tidal flooding, but we're also seeing groundwater flooding. What we have a situation, sometimes you hear it called nuisance flooding, or sunny day flooding, but really what it is chronic flooding. You know, a couple of times a month or more even, we have the high tide coming into our communities, and even further impacts from groundwater flooding. As sea level rises, it pushes the groundwater up. So all along the south shore of Long Island, we're seeing basements flooded. We're seeing our stormwater infrastructure unable to drain our streets because it's already full of seawater or groundwater. So we're seeing a lot of impacts already, especially in those most low-lying, most vulnerable areas. And those are the places that are starting to think, well, we need to start planning here because this is really becoming a problem. It's not a problem of the future. It's a problem of right now.
Allison, Molly Babin is on the line with us also. She's with the New Haven Climate Movement. Hi, Molly. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. When we talk about rising waters, I want to focus just for a moment, if we can, on New Haven and a number of the municipalities that are nearby New Haven. And I'm talking about Milford, West Haven, East Haven, Brantford, and so on. You go out, you speak with people, right, about this issue. What are you hearing? Are people scared? Anyone getting ready to move? Or do they think this is a bunch of hot air, so to speak?
Right. That's a great question. So there's definitely a fear, and you definitely hear it among a lot of younger people who our group has a lot of youth who live in Fairhaven in very vulnerable areas. And they definitely are thinking about the future and feeling very scared. But we do also hear a lot of types of denial where people don't want to think about that.
I'm just going to hold you right there because this occurred to me the other day. Is it a type of denial coming from one age group, or it seems that you're a college student, you're younger, your group seems to be, I think, more accepting of the data. When you say deniers, are you talking about older people?
We actually see it. We see it everywhere. We talk to people among many different socioeconomic statuses, and we tend to see the people who have been educated more, or have been exposed to more education, generally have less of a denial, but we also have seen it generally more among older people, for sure. Although a lot of older people have also been some of the greatest allies in our work.
So again, and I'm sorry to have cut you off there. Do you know anyone getting ready to move now? Or are they saying, look, in the next few years, I'm out of here, I'm going elsewhere?
I haven't met anyone who is currently making plans to move. But people are aware of that and they're aware that that could be a possibility.
Allison, when you go out and you speak with business owners or others along the coastline, the shoreline, and you say, look, this is happening. This is real. We need to make plans. And what kind of reaction are you getting?
I think initially there is a little bit of pushback. As I said, human nature is to avoid these changes. But I think once people start to really feel the impacts, they're ready to make changes. Unfortunately, where we are right now is we don't have a lot of good programs to give people the options they need to make the decisions that are right for themselves and their family and get out of harm's way. A lot of our spending on climate impacts is happening after disasters. Mm. And of course, that's important, but it would be a lot better use of funds to also invest pre-disaster, or it's not even really pre-disaster, it's sort of between disasters. There was a study, the National Institute of Building Sciences did a study that for every dollar you spend on hazard mitigation grants, you save $6 in future disaster costs. So while we do need to certainly help folks after disasters, we need to also be planning in advance to get people out of harm's way and sort of prevent that disaster spending.
Proper preparation, huh?
Right, and creation of programs that give people, sort of empower these communities that are being impacted to have options and to make the decisions that they need to make for themselves.
And I'm just going to ask you this one question, and I'm going to get Molly's perspective from Connecticut. Were you pleased by what happened in the New York Assembly and what Governor Cuomo signed in terms of climate change legislation and what New York State is it going to attempt to do over the next decade or two?
Absolutely. It's a really big deal, especially, in these days where the federal government is not really addressing climate change in a big way. It's great to be in a state where our elected officials are addressing it. They've set some really ambitious goals, which is fantastic. And there's a lot of work to do now to figure out how to actually achieve those goals. But that's all about climate mitigation, sort of preventing all these climate problems. But even if we do a fantastic job of that, we're still going to be seeing a lot of impacts for many, many years. So we need to now turn our attention to adapting to the changes that we're already seeing and that are going to get worse in the coming years, and start helping communities get ready to adapt.
Molly, it was a surprise to me because it seemed California is usually in the lead for something like this, and it seemed to me that New York State really just leapfrogged California in terms of what they're attempting to do. From the Connecticut perspective, are you seeing anything around Connecticut that you could point to and say this is the right way to go?
So Connecticut is not nearly as far along, in our opinion, as the New York bill. Our group primarily focuses on what we want New Haven to do, and we really want New Haven to have a full emergency response to climate change, declaring a climate emergency and having a mobilization. We believe that our city has a lot of power, and if our city declares a climate emergency, there is a much greater chance that our state will follow along. And that is ultimately our goal, is for our state to have a full mobilization against climate change, kind of like a statewide Green New Deal. But what we did see this past legislative session is an increase in wind power. We saw a plastic bag ban. We saw a fracking waste ban. But we didn't see anything as entirely major as what we need, as what we believe is the minimum we need in order to prevent such a costly and secure, a costly emergency.
When you say mobilization, what does that entail?
So our idea of mobilization comes from a think tank called the Climate Mobilization, and that is a global think tank that kind of has influenced the Green New Deal and other legislation, and that basically means having a very large-scale response and a very immediate response to climate change. This means having every department in the government report back, every department in the government doing its maximum to get rid of emissions, getting rid of all fossil fuel emissions within a couple decades. And a lot of this is connected back to what happened in America during World War II, where every person, every organization, every government department all came together to switch over the economy and all work together towards this one common purpose. We want to see a mobilization of that scale again, but against climate change this time. And we think that it could create many green jobs, hiring people to do things like installing solar panels. And it really can create community based on mobilizing over one large priority. It's really pushing climate change to the top of our priority list, because New Haven has done so many is not made of climate deniers. New Haven has had lots of little projects to get rid of our emissions and help our environment. But what we want to see is not little projects. What our group is trying to get past is one large mobilization that's a much higher scale and much more immediate than what we are seeing right now.
Hmm. Allison, I don't know if you heard the earlier part of the program. I had David Wallace Wells on the show. He's the author of The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. And reading his book, one of the things that I took away from it was that if some of what the researchers are now forecasting actually happen, that it will then turn around and make other aspects of global warming happen even faster. And so when I had the professors on from the First Street Foundation, and they were talking about, okay, the waters are going to rise in 15 to 30 years, they're going to go on. For some of the forecasts, if they come true, things will just pick up speed, which to me sounded terrifying.
It is terrifying. We're seeing a tremendous acceleration in the impacts of climate change. And what happens is, you've probably noticed over the last, 5, 10, 15 years, every time a new set of projections for sea level rise comes out, it's worse. And that's because as the science advances and the modeling gets better and better, we start to better understand sort of the feedbacks that happen with these different climate impacts, and they just make each other worse, so to speak. So, for example, as Arctic ice melts, the surface of the ice, instead of being white and shiny like ice is, it's now, wet, and it absorbs more heat. So then that makes the ice melt even faster. So feedback loops like that we're starting to better understand, which is just making our predictions worse and worse. I think, there's certainly a level, they call it uncertainty, but it's not really uncertainty. It's just a range of projections that we're seeing. But that range keeps going up. I don't really think that we're wrong and the climate is going to get cooler. I think that, you know, we might not know the exact date which we hit 2 degrees or whatever it is, but we know that it's warming and it's getting faster and faster, and it's time to start getting ready for that, as well as fixing what we've done wrong that's making it worse.
Allison, I have to ask, after hearing everything and knowing everything that you know, you optimistic, pessimistic for the future, for the outlook?
We have to be optimistic. What choice is there? That's why we work on these problems, because it's sort of the problem of our generation, and we have to address it. We have to all work together, and there is hope for us. It hasn't always been this way, and it doesn't have to be this way, but we need to start working on it now. It's a big problem to solve, and a lot of pieces need to come together, a bazillion different solutions all over the globe. So we have to get working on it right away so that we have a chance to make some dent in it before it makes it too late.
I hear you. We had Senator Chris Murphy from Connecticut on the show a few months back, and I'll never forget what he said. And I said, what's the most important issue? And he said, climate change. And he said, you know, he basically said, look, if we don't have a planet, everything else we're talking about doesn't matter. So
exactly right.
Fix this, because if we're not here, who cares?
Right.
Molly, what do you want the state to do? I know what you want New Haven to do. What do you want the leaders up in Hartford to be doing?
Well, leaders up in Hartford should be following in the footsteps of what we saw in New York, making a plan to get to 100% renewable energy within the next decade or two. We believe that we need to be working a lot faster at treating this like an emergency. Maybe we'll see a lot more investment into our public transportation, building much better public transportation so people could get around without cars, bike lanes, walking, transitioning to renewable energy, taking every department within our government and really thinking within each department what is the most that we can do, and implementing it into our education, having climate change education in the state, because it's the young people that are convincing our parents to care about this. And if there's an army of young people being taught in schools about climate change, they're our future, and they're the ones who can really be making huge pushes, as we've been seeing around America with the recent Sunrise Movement. And generally just treating it as if this was a real emergency, just like if there was an Ebola outbreak in the state, they would push all their resources to get rid of it. We want to see the same response in order to get rid of our fossil fuel emissions.
Allison, we have about 30 seconds left. I'm going to give you the last word. What are your final thoughts on this today?
My final thoughts are, as a community, we need to come together and recognize the reality that we're seeing, that the water is coming, the sea level is rising, and we need to begin to prepare so that we can make it through these changes and still have strong, vibrant economies and healthy, happy people.
Allison Branco is Director of Coastal Programs for the Nature Conservancy in New York, and Molly Babin is with the New Haven Climate Movement. Molly, Allison, thank you. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
I'll speak with you soon. If you'd like to comment on today's program, you can drop us an email. We're at tfs@wshu.org. You can find us on Twitter at FullStoryWSHU, or my own Twitter account, which is Ron Ropiak, WSHU. And as always, you can leave us a voicemail. Our number is 833-CALL-TFS. That comes out to 833-225-5837. That's going to do it for our show today. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Carrie Frank is the digital editor. Our associate producers are Christian Carter, Sabrina Garone, Natalie Chafari. J.D. Allen is the producer. Ann Lopez is the senior producer. And Terry Sheridan, our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to you for being part of the Full Story.